Yeah. Oh, should I? Here's the same. Krishna, Krishna. Yes, yeah, so it's nice to be back in Dallas again. And when we were here a year ago, we spoke about the great potential that the Dallas ISKCON community has for indeed making an urban community. And a year ago, we spoke about how, in spite of so much rapid communication systems, smartphones, internet, high-speed broadband, whatever, so much social networking, people are more lonely than ever before. We spoke about how, instead of technology bringing people together, as was the promised dream, it's actually isolated people more and more. Some of you may remember I told you about an advertisement for a housing development. Does anyone remember that? No. Okay, so it's a true advertisement. It was meant to catch people's attention, but it was also speaking truth at the same time. It was for a upmarket home, new housing development. So the developers were advertising, this house, it's like a three-bedroom house, has an office for the husband on the opposite side of the house from the office for the wife. And there's an separate internet alcove for each family member, so that no one has to see one another while they're on the internet. And the husband and wife can be completely separate with their offices on far sides of the house. And then the advertisement said, this is the perfect home for today's dysfunctional family. It's a true advertisement. How much do people really want to deal with each other? Maybe you've wondered that yourself. People like to pride themselves on being for real. And maybe you've even said that to someone else, looking into their eyes, I'm for real. Any of you ever done that before? Yes? And you probably meant it for the moment, right? Sometimes you don't mean it, but you say it because it sounds good. So people have a thirst for genuineness, authenticity. And that thirst or quest for genuineness and authenticity comes out in their, especially in their relationship making. You'd like that in your relationships. You'd like genuineness. Of course, failing that, you figure, at least let the relationship help pass the time, fill the days and nights. But what your heart really longs for is genuineness, authenticity in your personal affairs, authentic reciprocation. Because people are not getting that, even though they have such a compared to previous decades, they have such advanced communication technology. Therefore, they're so lonely. They're making full use of contemporary methods for forming relationships, matchmaking agencies, all sorts of things. They get so desperate. Recently, in Sydney, Australia, there was a case where two men started a scam. They started their dating agency for high-achieving female bankers. They pitched their business toward high-achieving female bankers who were approaching their 40s and suddenly realized We've got such career advancement. You know, we're vice president of this bank or that or the other. But something is missing. How do we, while not sacrificing our top level banking careers, how do we acquire a relationship? So this matchmaking agency came to the rescue. We will match you up with an appropriate male banker. So they had about 100 clients, charging them $20,000 each. How much is that altogether? Yeah, they took in $2 million from 100 clients, $20,000 each. It turned out that these two men, one manned, he staffed the dating agency. The other was the man. So all the ladies were actually dating the same man. So it was great business, wasn't it? $2 million. Huh? Yeah, he was just, you know, he was just, that was his job, you know. I am the man. Each woman got, you know, got the same date. And this went on for like a couple of years before somehow or other some of the ladies knew each other. And after 2 years only did the scam emerge. Because the dating agency was promising to relieve all their anxieties. You're not going to be lonely anymore. You're going to have a good relationship with someone of equal stature with you. It won't slow down your career. In fact, it will enhance your career. They're just an example of how hungry people are, that therefore they'll even plunk down big sums of cash in the hope of authenticity. The dating agency will save us the trouble of sifting through so many candidates. Or, even more markedly, the dating agency will save you time because you've devoted, and you are devoting, so much of your day and night to your career. You don't have the time to sift through all the candidates. So the dating agency comes to the rescue. And in the case of this scam, they convinced so many persons that we are here to help. We can help. So what does this say about the yearnings of our heart? Generally, from what I've seen around the world, ladies will readily agree that they have heart yearnings, but men, they don't like to talk about that. Although actually underneath the hard shell, men are very emotional beings. Therefore, if their female companion whom they actually care for suddenly leaves, men can actually consider committing suicide. Because underneath the hard shell of typical male insensitivity, and they're actually very emotional. As I said, under the shell, the outer shell is all about world conquest, making your mark in the world. But then inside, they love to be babied. And of course, the ladies, they have their wants for security, softness, tenderness. You may wonder, how will bhakti satisfy these yearnings of your heart? You've read Nectar Devotion. You know about the higher stages of bhakti. But you may be thinking right now, down here on the ground, what's going to plug the hole in the heart? What's going to fill the gap? So this is a subject that every bhakti practitioner has to start to deal with sooner or later. The heart issues. When you're a newcomer, you're fresh out of Maya's clutches. Yeah, you've been incinerated, burned to ashes in the quest for material enjoyment. So it takes you a while to recover. So your first years in bhakti, first couple of years at least, are characterized by just feelings of relief. Mainly feelings of relief. Oh, it's so great to be around devotees. Oh, it's so wonderful to be in kirtan, to take prasad. Oh, this is just so nice. And you're feeling relief, and you should. It's like you've just come out of the scorching desert. I just came from Las Vegas on Sunday where, you know, it's going up to 40 degrees. Oh, you don't think in Celsius, so Fahrenheit, I don't know what is. and it's not humid also. It's just like you bake in an oven. So, coming to Dallas, yeah, it's, you feel, that's cooler here. So, just think about your first years in bhakti. Remember when you first started associating with devotees? They all look shining. They all look like angels. And you felt that you were like a misfit around so many shining, luminous beings from another planet. Remember you felt like that? Every devotee was shining. And then what happened as the years go by? The reality starts to hit you that practically all these devotees that you know, for the most part, you would, in your material life, you wouldn't associate with these persons. These aren't the kind of persons you would hang out with on the material plane, right? You can even look at your own, other than our devotees from Indian background, you can even look at your own husband or wife and think, I would never be with you other than Krishna consciousness. You're just not my type for material life. So the truth starts to hit you after a couple of years. Of course, generally, our devotees from Indian background, they still have arranged marriages, not as constrained as in previous decades where you had to accept your parents' choice. Now you can opt out. But you generally go along in order to please the parents. And therefore still, after some time, you can discover that, this person's quite a different person. As your first years in bhakti go by, you start to understand that devotees are very different from you materially. And as we said, normally you wouldn't hang out, associate with such types. The truth starts to hit you between the eyes. Most devotees don't think like you. And most of them don't do things the way you do them. And this is when crisis starts to happen. Oh my God. They just don't think like I do. In the beginning, you know, the first 2 years, you're blinded by the effulgence that you see. But what happens after a couple of years? Start seeing the faults, right? You start seeing how, they're just, a lot of devotees, they're just not up to the standard of what their philosophy says, and especially since, you know, they don't listen to me. They haven't acknowledged my glories. So that's what happens as the years go by. Your feelings of relief also subside. Because how long can you just go on based on relief? The feeling that you get coming in from a very hot day into an air-conditioned room. How long can you go on expressing that relief. It wears thin. So at that point, after a first couple of years in our bhakti, when the relief wears off, we need to have something else going for us. And I notice a lot of devotees neglect this. They neglect to deal with their hearts in bhakti. The real issue is the heart issue. Because the philosophy is all about the heart. Impure heart, pure heart. So bhakti combines both the head and the heart in the most extraordinary way. And that's why so many of you are attracted to the bhakti science. You've never seen anything like it before. The most dazzling intellectualism combined with the most penetrating, heart-potent flavors. Never seen anything like it. And there's nothing like it. So after the first couple of years, you got to deal with the heart issue. You have to face the fact that your heart has yearnings. It has longings. So how do you handle that in bhakti? Because if we don't know how to handle our heart in bhakti, we'll certainly try to deal with it materially. The whole science of bhakti is meant to impart to you the confidence that you can deal with your heart successfully in bhakti. We need that confidence because let's face it, we're a little shaky. So many of you will say, or have said, yeah, I really like the philosophy. At the same time, though, you don't want to say it too loudly, but what about me? What about my heart? What about my desires? Generally, ladies will readily admit to that. Men, they're kind of gruff about it. But still, men will come up with their action program to deal with their heart without admitting it. We must learn the art, science, and culture of how to deal with our heart in bhakti. And that means honesty in realizing that our hearts are always longing for something. Lord Chaitanya has given us the method of longing for Krishna's service, longing for chanting Krishna's name with attachment. These Shikshastika prayers are the most profound outpouring of the heart. Dridaivam Idrisa Mahajani Nanuraga. I'm so unfortunate. I have no raga, no attachment for chanting Hare Krishna. That's something we have to accept as a constant companion. Our feeling that we're not able to chant Hare Krishna with enough attention. We're never going to think that now I'm chanting perfectly. There's always going to be the feeling that my chanting is not good enough. I cannot cry out to Krishna deeply enough. It's always going to be like that. Because as I often explain, we are following in the footsteps of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. And as Srila Prabhupada explained about them, their mission was never fulfilled. They never presented themselves as having achieved Krishna. Krishna's always just ahead. He's never in their grasp. And Lord Chaitanya demonstrated that. Obviously, the six Goswamis are following in the footsteps of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya himself came to taste that mood of viraha bhava, separation from Krishna. So those in the line of Lord Chaitanya are always cultivating feelings of separation from Krishna, which on the highest levels of bhakti are more ecstatic than meeting Krishna. That's why the six Goswamis always present themselves as bereft of Krishna. Where is he? Hey Rad, hey Braja Devi Ke Chalalite, hey Nanda Sunokrita. Queen of Vrindavan, where are you? Oh Lalita, oh son of Nanda Maharaj, where are you? Are you on the bank of the Jumena River? Are you on Govardhan Hill? Where are you? This is our inheritance. And this emotional inheritance is what will fully satisfy the heart. Those of you who have Red Nectar Devotion should know that that's a handbook for the heart. How to purify the heart and how to express the heart in pure bhakti. So how do we begin to deal with our heart? We'll admit, yes, the advanced stages of bhakti are ahead of us. So what to do now? The practice of sadhana bhakti gives you the opportunity to invest your heart in devotional service. And that saves you from investing your heart in material activities. You have to do something with your heart energies. You have to know how to invest in bhakti, even in the beginning stages. Because material life is also demanding of your heart. That's the job of Maya, the illusory energy. Give me a heart and I'll stomp on it. But we're so attached, right? We're so attached to investing our heart, we'll do it again and again. Again and again, we'll invest in Maya with our heart, and we get stabbed in the heart. This is how determined we are, how stubborn we are. It shows you how attached we are to fulfilling our heart. That even though investing our heart in material activities proves always to be so painful and such a disappointment, we'll still do it again and again. That's why Krishna in Bhagavad Gita characterizes our situation as mudha janmini janmini. Birth after birth, you're a fool. Now, it's bad enough, as I always explain, it's bad enough to be a fool one time. But birth after birth? Why do we do that? Because of the desire seeds in our heart that want fulfillment, even though the material energy will never fulfill your desires satisfactorily. It's not going to happen. But those desires are so strong that they push us onward and onward in such a futile expression. And then we look around and we see everyone else is doing like that. Surely someone, somewhere is getting satisfied by investing their heart in material activities. If I just try harder. Just like, for example, you know the marriage statistics in the USA. I always quote marriage statistics in the USA when I'm down under in Australia and New Zealand, because in Australia and New Zealand, few people bother to marry. So I always have to say, and in the USA, they don't bother to marry. So the government just says, hey, if you're living together for, some say it's now down to 1 year, but it used to be 2 years. If you're living together for a certain amount of time, we consider a de facto marriage. And so all the men are very careful, because what happens, you know, what happens if, you know, your marriage enters the de facto time, your relationship enters the de facto marriage period, what happens? No, it means when you're divorced, 50%. So all the men are calculating. Month number 11. Well, the government's done like that because no one, you know, no one's marrying. There was one devotee from India living in New Zealand, and he was marrying a British girl who was also living in New Zealand. And so they wanted, before the fire yajna, the Vedic marriage ceremony, they wanted a civil ceremony. So they went to the city marriage office. That was an office that handled all records of things like that, marriage, birth, death, all that kind of thing. So he went up, he went up to the secretary and said, he had his fiance with him. We'd like to arrange for legal marriage. We know there's, we expect there's going to be a few weeks waiting list, but we'd like to, if you could somehow get us to the top of the list. Yeah, he's from Calcutta, so he figured, a little grease the rails a bit. So he presented the situation. We'd like a legal marriage as soon as possible, in spite of the long wait that probably is going to be. All of a sudden, all the secretaries in the office burst out laughing. It was laugh for 3 minutes. He couldn't figure out what was going on. And they saw that he was amazed. And they said, don't you know? No one comes here to get married. No one gets married anymore. So that's the reason why in my talks I have to use statistics from the USA. Of course, this is the USA, and you know that the divorce rate for the first marriage is over 50%, and it only gets worse. Second marriage, 65%. Third marriage, 75%. So that shows you that people, they don't know what to do with their hearts. I was once on a plane from Delhi to Bangkok, and the man next to me struck up a conversation. Turned out he was the head engineer, project manager for the construction of the Delhi subway. And so he's an American man, but he was the head. And he was going back to the States to visit family, relatives like that. And so he was telling me about his life. My first marriage lasted 10 years. I divorced her 2 years ago. It just wasn't working, As everyone knows, the first marriage is just you're declaring yourself on the marriage scene. You're just getting out on the playing field. No one expects it to last. I said, well, how's the second one going? Yeah, I've been with her for about a year. And it's just not working. The fire's not there. I said, what do you mean the fire's not there? What do you expect? I said, I don't know, but it's just not there. It shows you very poignantly how helpless people are. They'll go on and on and on, making this adjustment, that arrangement, trying to deal with their heart. They can try in terms of relationships, or they can try in terms of careerism. Some people they have their hearts totally into their career. And they think that the career is going to do everything for them. And they end up bitterly disappointed, but you have to do something with your heart. Some kind of achievement. Some kind of acquisition. That's why so many people treat relationships like consumer goods these days. You acquire a relationship. You dispose of a relationship. The same mentality as if you're changing jobs, changing careers, changing houses, changing your iPhone, changing relationships. If you start looking at people from the viewpoint that they don't know what to do with their heart, then you're actually seeing what's going on. But we don't want this situation to be the case for our bhakti practitioners. So we should be discussing these things openly. How bhakti can fulfill the true desires of your heart. Because what happens as the years go by in bhakti, you're starting to wonder, I'm not quite where I want to be in terms of my spiritual life, but I'm not as bad as I used to be about material life. So you're kind of stuck in the middle, right? And it kind of seems like, well, I'm not able to go forward. I don't want to go backwards. What do you do? Forward ahead of me is the, it seems, unattainable heights of more purified bhakti. It seems far away. But if I look behind me from where I came, I see the blazing fire of material existence. I'm not supposed to go that way either. What to do? You can't stand still. And this is a point many of our devotees have to learn. You can't make a plateau. There's no plateaus in this world. Everything is dynamic. The material energy is dynamic. The spiritual energy is dynamic. You have to take shelter as a tiny living entity, part of Krishna. You have to take shelter of one of Krishna's energies. You can't imagine that there's a plateau you can hang out on. A plateau on which you can just tread water. You know, you're swimming in a pool and you get tired of swimming, you just tread water. But you can't do that in bhakti for long. Because you're, the nature of the reality that you're living in is a dynamic one. The spiritual world is dynamic. The material world is dynamic. Of course, the dynamics of the material world are shadowy, illusory, insubstantial, but still they're dynamics. So often, hopefully you've read in Srimad Bhagavatam how Maya has two departments, the throwing department and the covering department. What does the throwing department do? It gets into your head and just roars. Who do you think you are practicing Krishna consciousness? Do you really think you're kind of some kind of saint? Just drop it. Be normal. Get real. This is the throwing potency of Maya, capable of hurling you out of your spiritual practices. Maybe it happens very gradually corroding. Maybe it's all of a sudden. And then there's the covering potency of Maya. Once you're in her clutches, she covers you over so that you really don't even know what hit you. You don't even know what happened. And you find yourself just in the dark. So Maya has a thankless task. She's serving Krishna, and her thankless task is to keep insincere persons away from Krishna. We shouldn't begrudge Krishna for having that kind of department, that kind of servant. Because in our heart, we all wish we had that kind of energy, that kind of PA, personal assistant secretary, sorting things out for us. So that's what Maya does. She keeps those who are not sincere in heart, she keeps them away from Krishna. You know how life is in this world. There's always anxiety in the business world. Am I being cheated? Is this business partner on the level? And then in your personal relationships, there can be anxiety. Is this person really true to me? Is this person telling me the truth? Is this relationship being genuine? So Krishna never goes through those anxieties. He has an energy that sorts out his affairs. So Krishna never leaves himself exposed to insincere hearts. He's the supreme enjoyer. He's the supreme lover. He knows how to do everything perfectly. What we hunger for so much, how to thrive in a perfect relationship. Krishna does that without any strain, without any effort at all. He has his energies that arrange everything. So that's the thankless task of Maya, to protect Krishna from those with ulterior agendas, impure motivations, those with cheating desires. You know, in the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, it is stated, Dharma Projita Kaitavotra Paramo Namatsaranam Satam. The Bhagavatam lets you know right from the beginning. It sweeps out any desire other than the pure desire to satisfy Krishna. It sweeps out even the desire for liberation from material existence. Sometimes we may feel discouraged that my heart's not pure. It's got some material desires. What is my future in bhakti? We need to develop the confidence that Krishna knows how to handle our hearts. He knows how to handle our desires. Lacking that confidence in Krishna, we seek fulfillment in the material energy. And that's where things get dangerous. We seek fulfillment in the mirage of material existence. This is one reason why, in Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami forbids you from having heart-sharing sessions with non-practitioners. He said, you don't practice loving exchanges because you'll be taking things into your heart that you don't want to take in, that you shouldn't want to take in. But in intimately associating with non-practitioners, inadvertently, even unconsciously, you take on their worldview, you take on their desires, their contaminations. A bhakti yogi is very careful about what goes on in the heart. And as you know, Lord Chaitanya demonstrated that in his cleansing of the Gundicha Mandir. He cleaned the place thoroughly of all gross and subtle particles of dust. Even using his own top piece to clean the Gundicha temple. Even washing the temple with his own tears, demonstrating how we should focus on our heart and seek to purify it. So are we alone in our quest to deal with our heart? Are we unaided? What makes us think that it's going to be hopeless? What makes us think that we're just left to our own devices to try to advance in spiritual life? We have no recourse. We have no support. What makes us think like that? It's a question we need to ask ourselves, because this is a prominent trick of illusory energy to make you feel isolated. No one understands you. No devotees have ever been through what you've been through. Maya assures you. Believe me, I know. No one has ever gone through this situation. Actually, as the decades go by in bhakti, you realize you're just seeing rerun movies. Everything that devotees go through, it's been gone through over and over and over again. But it's amazing how that illusory energy makes us think that no one understands you. Don't even try to open up. Don't even try to consult anyone. They don't know. They don't understand. So that feeling of isolation really damages us. And then you start losing confidence in the bhakti process. And naturally, as you lose confidence in the bhakti process, you start to seek shelter in the material world. You start to seek shelter in materially dedicated persons who start to seem normal to you. How to avoid losing confidence in Krishna? Well, of course, you know that associating with determined devotees also gives you a taste of determination. And you pay more attention to what Krishna is saying. Because Krishna explains himself so clearly in Bhagavad Gita. He tells you all that you need to know. Tesham avanukampata mahamajanatam tamaha nasyami atma bhavasto ganadipena bhashvata. Krishna says, out of compassion for you, he says, I in your heart will turn on the shining lamp of knowledge and dispel the darkness of ignorance. So he's disclosing what he's going to do within your heart. As Srila Prabhupada writes in one purport in Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna is not lazy in your heart. Sometimes we think that. What is he doing? Paramatma. In the beginning stages of bhakti, you're not completely aware of what Paramatma is doing, because Paramatma acts very gravely. That's what Lord Chaitanya told Sanatana Goswami after Sanatana Goswami escaped from prison to join Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya told him that Krishna has delivered you from material existence, acting within your heart very gravely. He's made these arrangements. So in the beginning, you may not know that. You may not notice. And so when you have shaky moments and you're starting to feel uninspired and you lose your confidence in Krishna, you may actually subtly accuse Krishna. What are you doing? You're supposed to be Paramatma in my heart. What help is that for me? Just see how polluted my heart is. Why don't you do something? How can you leave me to just suffer, writhing on the hook? Do something. Do something. Otherwise, I'm just going to have to give up this process. It's all your fault. You're the super soul in the heart. You're not doing enough for me. But if we think the reality that Krishna is active in your heart, and he describes what he'll do, but we may not see that. So much of the bhakti process depends on developing a different vision in order to see what Krishna is doing. In Srimad Bhagavatam, you know the verse, Shinvatam Sukata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hiryantasto Hirbhadrani Vidunoti Suhrit Satam. Krishna, the super soul in your heart, when he sees that you are eager to hear about him, he, so to speak, goes to work. He personally cleanses desires for material enjoyment from your heart. So we have to stick with the bhakti process long enough that we can detect what's going on in our heart. It takes a while. Generally, when you first come to bhakti, you know it's a miracle, and you know Krishna in my heart has been merciful to me. He's arranged for my associating with devotees. But as the first couple of years go by, you may lose sight of this miracle and lose your confidence. So I see that so many of our devotees, they need a little push. They need some support once they go past the beginning years and start entering the intermediate years. They need a little extra incentive, because they're not in material life. They're not freshly escaped from material life, and they're not advanced in bhakti on the higher levels. So therefore, they feel like they're caught between a rock and a hard place. So at this time, at this moment, at this phase in your spiritual life, the way to get out of this fix is by increasing your spiritual dynamics. Because you have to go one way or the other. It's like in a relationship. Once the honeymoon phase is over, you've got to start dealing with the actual day-to-day dynamics of the relationship. One statistic I often quote, you may have heard it before, how scientists calculate averages for everything. And so there is a calculation for the worldwide average and duration of romantic feelings. It's 17 months. For that mean average of 17 months, that means some less, some more. You're flying. The dopamine in your brain is flowing. The neurochemicals released when you're caught in romance are now known to be as powerful as cocaine and just as addictive. That buzzy feeling that you get. Like the whole world is whirling and you're flying high due to the relationship. Those are neurochemicals. So once those chemicals wear off, you have to start, if you want the relationship to last, you have to start dealing with the day-to-day realities and dynamics. So similarly, in bhakti, we shouldn't be afraid of looking deeply into our heart and doing some surgery if necessary. That should become fashionable and the standard for our bhakti practitioners. Open heart surgery. It's a wonderful thing about reading Prabhupada's books. If you really let them penetrate your heart, they do amazing things. Because Prabhupada's books have the complete cooperation of the super soul. The language may not be ornate according to books that you usually read, because English was Prabhupada's, wasn't his first language. But in spite of that, in spite of the vocabulary, that's just a few hundred words actually, those words in Srila Prabhupada's books have the power to turn the lights on in your heart and illuminate so many things, if you let them do that. We have so many sources of heart illumination that we can turn to, if we have that desire. If we don't, however, we get caught in the undercurrent of the illusory energy. And it may take some time. It may happen overnight in very unfortunate cases, or in other cases, it may take a time for gradual corrosion. It's stated in Nectar Devotion that for one who wants to keep things as they are in the heart, it's very difficult to make advancement in bhakti. So that means we need a militant, proactive attitude about dealing with our heart affairs. And what's so unusual about that? In material life, we're always eager to invest our hearts in this and that. And you'll accuse anyone of not treating your heart properly. Sure, almost everyone here has done that. You let me down. You're ignoring me. You're not meeting my expectations. Whether it's a parent talking to a child, or husband talking to wife, or in any kind of relationship. Friend talking to friend. When you feel that your heart is not being properly dealt with, you get very militant. So why can't we give Krishna and his service that same sense of urgency and priority? So we need to know how to invest our hearts in bhakti. We can't just be inactive with our hearts, because Krishna is not inactive in our heart. He's active. So we need to reciprocate with Krishna by having a desire to invest our heart energies in devotional service. By doing that, we get over the hump and we gain confidence in Krishna. Because you have to have this proactive program once the feelings of relief wear off. Which they will. No doubt, coming to bhakti is like escaping the maelstrom and you're on the oasis. You're out from the desert into the oasis. But as we pointed out earlier, that feeling can't last for long. And you'd be very wrong to just rest on your laurels of having escaped from the material energy. Congratulations, you've made the perfect escape. But now what are you going to do? So we don't want to be, shall we say, we don't want to imitate Buddhists. The stock definition of nirvana is you're out of the forest of illusion. That's literally what nirvana means. Vana means forest, nir means out of. So you're out of the forest of illusion, but where are you? You can't just exist being out of illusion. You have to be into something. So that applies to our heart. We can't have a voidistic approach to our heart. Mm-hmm. I believe in Krishna. I know the philosophy. Bhakti is actually not a belief system. It is a heart therapy program. You may believe or not so many things, but what about your heart? Of course, in bhakti, it runs on two rails, jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. Those two rails deal with the core of your being and your desires. So once we make the centerpiece of our life dealing with our heart, the seeds of desires in our heart, and we're proactive about it, we don't have a lackadaisical, laissez-faire attitude. Yeah, well, my heart, whatever's there is there, you know. Krishna's not lazy in your heart, and similarly, we should not be lazy and casual about our heart. Now, one last point. It may seem like hard work to always be mindful of your heart. That feeling that it's hard work comes because of laziness that the age of Kali brings. Manda sumanda mateo, manda bhagya hupadruta. In the age of Kali, everyone is manda, very slow about self-realization, very quick about material affairs, very slow about self-realization. So that sluggishness about self-realization means that we can be affected by laziness in dealing with our heart. I don't want to go there. I don't want to. I'd rather not look at my heart. I'd rather keep busy. So sometimes devotees are shocked when someone who's been around in bhakti for a while takes a turn into the illusory energy. It's upsetting, no doubt. And you wonder, what's going to happen to me? If that could happen to that person, what about me? In so many of those cases, you find, if you know the person, that they neglected to be proactive about their heart. And they went year after year doing devotional service mechanically. That means without confronting their heart and dealing with it in a proactive way. And so after a while, those heart desires manifested in a non-positive way. And they had to go with that. You can only ignore your heart for so long before you have to go with it. So don't be afraid to wrestle with your heart. Don't be afraid of being very proactive and even militant about handling your heart and what to do with its energies. Because in the heart are the seeds of desire accumulated for many lifetimes. To counteract all that habit energy from so many lifetimes, to break that habit energy, we We need to know how to invest our hearts in the bhakti process. Through the chanting, through the kirtan. Of course, no one has any problem taking prasad in a hearty way. Through the practical duties of devotional service. So much of dealing with your heart can be done progressively by just a sense of duty. That's why in the bhakti process, the sadhana process of vaidhi bhakti, doing things because you must, is the legitimate precursor, the preliminary to doing things because you feel like it. We need to understand that doing things out of duty will purify the heart and lead to doing things because you feel like it. I feel like serving Krishna. But first, there has to be the purifying program of doing things, taking your medicine because you're supposed to. While doing that, we should have a vision for the whole bhakti process, that it's not always going to be like that. You are going to develop a taste for serving Krishna. Have that confidence. Those of you who read Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers, you may remember Srila Prabhupada's very simple definition of sadhana bhakti. Anyone remember? Sadhana bhakti means you have to do it because I say it. The doctor says, just take the medicine. Because you want to get well, you do what the doctor says. Otherwise, why you go to a doctor? Your understanding is that by taking the medicine, you're going to get well and you'll be able to function normally. So similarly, we perform the duties of devotional service not blindly. We are aware of what the outcome is that will develop a spontaneous desire to serve Krishna. Keeping that outcome in mind is done by good association, by hearing in the company of eager devotees. So please allow me to leave this point with you tonight. How our heart situation is most important in bhakti. We're not theoretical believers. Our philosophy is very penetrating and very therapeutic. It's actually dealing with the core dynamics of life. We may misconceive the philosophy as being something way up there in the air. And meanwhile, here we are down on the ground. But actually, the bhakti knowledge is dealing with the deepest core issues of our being. And by dealing with those core issues of your being, you're more able to cry out to Krishna like a child calls for mother, the ideal state of chanting. All right, we'll stop here for now. Maybe you have some points you'd like to discuss. Yes.
Yeah, Maharaj. Listening to you, it makes me think that this problem of impersonalism is more than this philosophical debate on whether God is a person or not, but it has this effect on us now that even marriage can be impersonal and our lives, the world is becoming so impersonal.
Well, think deeply when we offer pranam mantras to Srila Prabhupada. We say, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacha Desha Tarani. He came to rescue the Western world from impersonalism and voidism. Now, do we really think about that? Or we, well, that's not me. That's the other people. That's the Mayavadi yogis. That's the, that's the Buddhist. Not me. No, I'm. Our impersonalism is shown by our insensitivity to Krishna. Our hard-heartedness. And that hard-heartedness reveals itself in our determination to enjoy the material world. We become so dog stubborn that even we're hurting ourselves, we don't even care, we don't even notice. So we're not even being properly selfish. You know that verse in Bhagavad Gita, the 12th chapter, where Krishna says, Yasmin no vijate loko, one is very dear to me who doesn't cause agitation to others. So I remember once Prabhupada presented that verse as, yes, you become very dear to Krishna by not causing agitation to others, and especially to yourself. Don't cause agitation to yourself. So let's just think about that. Due to our impersonal contamination, we don't even treat the person of ourself properly. We put ourself in such compromising situations, dangerous situations, all for the sake of material goals. So we have to first learn how to be personal with ourselves, how to be personal with others, and certainly how to be personal with Krishna. And it's a gradual purifying process. But while undergoing that gradual purifying process, we should have the confidence that we're doing the most important thing. The greatest career goal is dealing with your heart and purifying it. That's the greatest career goal. And so what if it takes you all your life? Is there any better career goal to try for? Now, let's say, I always give this example. Someone starts working for a corporation, you know, as soon as they get their MBA or whatever, you know, they're 24, 25, and they spend 35 years rising up the corporate ladder. So by the time they're 60, 65, they're on the board there. Yeah. Now, no one would criticize him for that. Oh, very good. Very good life. You started off at the low levels of the corporation, and now 35 years later, you're on the board. Oh, very good. Very good. Never mind that it took you 35 years. People appreciate that. Now, if we say you took up your Krishna consciousness when you were 25, and now it's only when you're 60 that you're starting to see your way through it all. Oh, how did you put up with it for that long? Didn't you? This is our double standard. It still affects us. We show patience for material achievement and impatience for achieving the bhakti goals. So what if it takes you all your life to chant Hare Krishna with attention? So what? In Australia, a few years ago, maybe the turn of the century, there was this Australian who actually became CEO of McDonald's. And he was in his mid-40s when he became CEO of McDonald's throughout the world. And of course, the business magazines, especially in Australia, were lauding him. He rose from the bottom to the top. He's in his mid-40s now, and already he's on the top of the pile. A few years later, he died of cancer. Mm-hmm. But no one would say, well, that's a wasted life. No, he rose to the top. Doesn't matter that he died. He rose to the top. That's the kind of standards we're dealing with. Never mind that you don't know who you are, why you're in this world. Never mind all the bad karma you're piling up for yourself by being CEO of McDonald's. You made it to the top. You know, that you died at the age of 47, that's just a footnote, you know? Your picture will be on the wall. Is that what you want for yourself? So he's started off when he was like 20 working for McDonald's. So that's 25 years before he got to the top. If we say, however, 25 years before you get a glimpse of the full glories of bhakti, then everyone groans. Oh, can't wait that long. That's a long time. Right? This is a double standard. We formulate that standard based on material criteria. That's why it's so necessary to repeatedly hear about the science of bhakti, because then our criteria start to change. And we realize, so what if I spend a whole lifetime chasing attentiveness to the holy name? There's nothing better to do, and it's all worth it. Lord Chaitanya himself has that mood. Mama janmani janmani srede baba tad bhakti hoi tiki tui. I don't care if I take birth after birth as long as I have devotional service. So we don't hold a gun to Krishna's head saying, I give me bhakti by this time or else. It is so worth it that from the heart, we cry out, just let me have service. Just let me chant the Hare Krishna mantra. We don't put a time schedule on to Krishna. But Krishna himself says, out of compassion for you, this is what I'm going to do. He tells you what his program will be. But we're not so good at seeing what Krishna is doing. And also, it is a fact that Krishna acts very gravely in the heart. Yet, so many devotees can testify that when they became aware deeply of how Krishna's representative, were actually reciprocating with them, it was exactly the best moment. Couldn't have been better timing. So many devotees had that experience. But before they had that experience, then it's, oh, when is Krishna going to show up? When will Krishna's representative notice me? So it's a cumulative experience in bhakti that you start to have confidence that Krishna knows what he's doing. Any other questions? Yes.
Maharaj, thank you so much for a powerful lecture. It's very motivating for us. I'm fairly new, so I fall into the category that you mentioned earlier. I see everybody very shiny.
Very good.
I wanted to ask about one thing you mentioned about practitioners, that you know how we have to drop and keep with the strong or motivated practitioners. When we are dealing with, so as a newcomer, you know, I'm very enthusiastic, I like it, enjoy it, I want to practice more. At the same time, I have obviously family, extended family, friends, and office and everything. So if we have to start balancing that, how do we start dropping things, how do we motivate others to understand, listen, where do we create this balance? Because with the, to be associated with only practitioners, we kind of start dropping everybody, including family members. And that is a very painful process.
When you say family members, do you mean like your nuclear family, your own family, or
my brothers, sisters, extended, or parents, or cousins, and then family, friends, everybody?
It's like learning how to swim. You gradually learn how to deal with that extended family system in such a way that you're respectful. At the same time, you're doing what you have to do for your bhakti practice. You will learn the art. It's not impossible. It's actually even mystical, being spiritual within the material world. So don't have this fear that it's going to be such a challenge for you. It's like a child learning how to walk. At first, it seems insurmountable, so difficult. But somehow you get up on your feet, start moving your legs, and you start to walk, and you start to be able to deal with complexity around you. But I know at first it can seem intimidating. Oh, what to do about my relatives? What to do about my office? That's why we need the support of devotees. They'll impart you the art of executing spiritual life within the material world. I give an example I often tell. There was one devotee in Australia. He was a corporate engineer, managing engineer. So he said, what do I do that, you know, my fellows at the workplace always want to talk to me about this, that, the other, and I just can't, you know, just be quiet because that's considered, you know, antisocial. It's considered that you're a loner. You're not a team player. So what do I do? I have to, you know, talk about something. Otherwise, you know, and they want to talk about so many things, which I'm not interested in. A Christian conscious person, not interested in. So what I advised him was, I said, find a material subject that's easy for you to talk about. One subject. And be known for that. Yeah, and that way they won't bug you to talk about everything, but they'll just say, oh, about this subject, he really knows. You can count on him. He's a religious man. He doesn't talk about so many things, but this thing, we can always rely on him. So I said, what is it? What's that subject? Easy for you. He said, cricket. Because whenever they have the corporation intramural cricket matches, they always want him. He's the captain, you know, for his side. So I said, all you do, you make that your thing. And they can pigeonhole you. They can typecast you that way. Oh, he doesn't talk about so many things, but he sure knows his cricket. And then they, so all you do is, before you go to work, you just look at the, you know, the sports headlines, you know, just see who won this match, who won that match. And that's all you talk about at work, you know. And they think, oh, he's normal. And they don't bother him about having to talk about so many crazy things, you know. They just know, he's quiet, but he sure knows his cricket. So you have to be strategic like that. So he did that, and it worked perfectly. They just need a hook, so to speak, to hang their coat on. We got him figured out now. It's like, what about me? I'm a sannyasi, but, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'm making my annual visit to my material relations, you know. I got to talk. What am I going to do? Just talk about Krishna 24 hours a day? I'm not ready for that. So I have to have a subject to talk to them about. Otherwise, they're going to want to talk to me about so many things. So I had to find something, a material subject that's easy for me to talk about. So what is it? Airlines. So when I'm there, I just, did you know United Airlines seats have 2 inches more leg room than American Airlines? They go, ooh, very valuable knowledge. The service at such and such airline is nothing compared to that one. And it's something, you know, it's easy for me to talk about and they can relate to. So Krishna will give you intelligence like that. So it's not like either you say nothing or you have to just totally compromise yourself. You just be strategic, be tactful. relate with the non-devotional world in a strategic way. But your heart's not invested into it. This is advice that Narada Muni gave Yudhisthira Maharaj in the 7th Canto of Bhagavatam. You do all these practical affairs, all these extended family duties, work duties, but you don't have your deep heart's desires invested into it. Externally, you're, yes, you know. But internally, you have another program. Got it? Yes.
Thank you very much for the explanation of the process. Having practiced for some time, you were mentioning that we should be militant and eager to take medicine. And I find it that there's some desire to take medicine, but then from there to get to the open heart surgery is quite, you know, that's a little daunting sometimes. And then,
if you're eager to take the medicine will work. The medicine will do that surgery. And we help the process by taking a look at our hearts and actually seeing what's going on. We shouldn't be afraid. We shouldn't ignore our heart. We should actually take a look and deal with it. That conscious help aids the bhakti process. That conscious assistance that you're giving to the bhakti process by yourself taking a look at what's in your heart helps the cleansing process. Yes.
I just have a question kind of about what he asked. Like, if you are ignoring your heart, sometimes we ignore our hearts and we think we're doing the right thing, you know? So, like, is there ways to know if you're ignoring your heart in a good way or a bad way?
Ignoring your heart in a good way means you actually see what's there, but because it's an inferior desire, you don't act on it. But you have to be aware of what's going on there. Because the heart's full of desire seeds from many, many lifetimes. So you should be aware of that, because they're pushing you around. And these seeds are sprouting in the course of time. That's why there's no such thing as an innocent child. Every child's body is filled with desire seeds that will sprout at the right time. So it's not about repression, it's about investing in Krishna's service. So try to understand the desires of your heart and how they actually can reach their full fulfillment in Krishna's service. So it's not that you're, you know, repressing yourself, you know, just wringing your hands until you turn blue in the face. And No. Yes, no. You have to have a superior program to invest your heart in. Yes?
Mars, this is similar to these other questions that are being asked, but you have so much confidence when you say be proactive with your own heart. You have the skills to know, it seems, how to identify it, what's going on, whereas most people don't have that skill of going very deeply and finding out what we're doing wrong and how to make it right and how to take deep shelter of the spiritual master to give us the intelligence how to respond.
Well, it's like if you're sick, you want to be cured, and so you try to understand your whole disease situation. That's why we have Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. They explain everything. And those books are available for everyone. But if we consider them just to be kind of metaphysical theology, then we miss their real impact. Their real impact is that they are capable of transforming the heart. And the whole bhakti process, all the 9 processes of devotional service are like that. So what I'm saying, that knowledge is available to everyone. Nothing special about what I'm saying. It's just something we may overlook because we're prone. Well, especially in the USA. You see, you might be surprised, but abroad, in the media abroad, like in Australia, New Zealand, UK, the US is known as a religious country. That's how the media refers to the USA, that religious country. Because in these other countries, these other English-speaking countries overseas, religion died 50 years ago. So, especially here in the USA, we may conceive of bhakti as kind of religious belief, and we miss out on its actual therapeutic dynamics. Well, I believe in Krishna, don't you? Now, I always point out, nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna ask you to believe in him. But particularly because this is a predominantly Christian country, belief, you know, believe is, you know, is embedded in everyone, that dynamic. But actually in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna never asks you to believe in him. Shockingly so. Everywhere in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I'm giving you the process. Apply it, and you'll get the results. So Bhagavad Gita is very, it's all about process, methodology. It's not about belief. But we bring that belief baggage to Bhagavad Gita. What should I believe? Where's the catechism? When actually, what Krishna's giving in Bhagavad Gita, he tells Arjuna, because you're not envious of me, I'm going to teach you the whole process by which you can attain this goal, that goal in bhakti. You'll obtain freedom from material existence. Just listen to me. I'll teach you the process. He doesn't ask for Arjuna's belief. Krishna doesn't have that kind of insecurity. Do you believe in me? It just doesn't. So the more we take the bhakti process as Krishna's giving in Bhagavad Gita, the more we see that you may believe, you may not believe. We have so many examples of persons who initially were not attracted to Krishna, but because some or other they happened to participate in the bhakti process, they became attracted. In fact, that is Srila Prabhupada's definition of management. He said, management means to create an interest in Krishna where there is none. That's management. Very unique definition. To create an interest in Krishna where there is none. That's management. So that means even persons, they have no belief in Krishna, but because they participate somehow or other in the bhakti process, they get experience, they get realization. When you touch fire, the fire doesn't ask you, do you believe in me? No, because you touch fire, something happens. So that's why we are very eager that we encourage persons to involve themselves in the bhakti process. Because they'll get experience, no matter what they believe or not believe. Yes.
First, I really wanted to thank you for your very direct class dealing with a lot of issues that grihasthas face.
Grihasthas? What about brahmacharya sannyasis?
Yeah, no problem.
And I just really wanted to thank you for it. I've been practicing trying to give Krishna my heart for over 20 years, and it was... And I think I speak for a lot of my friends here. It was very, very well presented. And I wanted to thank you for that, and thank you for your trip here to Dallas. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to ask you, because when you speak, it seems like you speak from such realization. What, if it's okay and it's not too forward to ask, what has been your personal experience in your bhakti process, and how? I remember hearing your class when I was 9 years old, many, many years ago.
Where?
It was a tape that my father had, and we were in Detroit. And here you are speaking the same. And so what has been, how have you achieved the success that you have achieved in spiritual life? If you can share with us a little bit about your personal journey.
Well, that's a big question.
What I was thinking today, one aspect that I can touch upon in answering your question, because it's a big question. It could take, you know, hours to answer. But I was thinking today about becoming peaceful in the heart about being the servant of the servant of the servant. Kind of dealing with that desire to assert oneself in the material world. Recognizing that contamination and learning how to become devotionally peaceful by being the servant of the servant of the servant. Because, you know, many of us are affected by corporate careerism or high-powered academic achievement, whether we may not know how deeply that effect goes. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I had that kind of background. I remember when I first took up the bhakti process, I made a vow to myself, which I kept for 5 years. I said, due to the complexities of my background, a high-powered, prestige academic background, which was supposed to have led to high-powered corporate success, but some other Prabhupada diverted me. So I said, due to my complexities, I'm not going to read any word except Prabhupada's books. And I did that for 5 years until I went to Eastern Europe in the communist days, and I had to be aware of world situations and things like that, politics, economics. So that's just one aspect, one example that... You recognize your influences, you recognize your background, and you proactively deal with that in bhakti. So I remember for 5 years, I never read one word of a newspaper or magazine and felt no loss. They had big events going on in the USA at the time. Nixon was impeached from office or resigned or whatever, and Vietnam War ending and all these kind of things. Never read any mundane news source. Then, 5 years later, when it was necessary, absolutely necessary for Krishna's service, I had to figure out how to conduct underground activities in former communist Europe. Then I had to be aware of so many mundane things. So I offer that as a humble example of how I tried to deal with myself, my background, my complexities. And also, in presenting bhakti to a non-Indian audience, you know, they don't have not simply a non-Indian audience, but audiences that don't have any religious background whatsoever. In America, I could say the religious country, people have, you know, nominal Christian background or Jewish background or something. But in a lot of countries that I deal with, English speaking, there's no concept of God. Sometimes in a joking way, I just, you know, audience of 100 persons, I say, how many of you went to Sunday school? Everyone, what? What's that? So And the word, even the word God sounds so strange to them. So in that kind of circumstance has pushed me to understand our heritage more deeply, that it's not about belief. It's not about belief as like Christian belief. It's not like how it's often thought in India. Oh, Bhagavad Gita. Oh, yeah, I know. I know. My grandmother read me stories from the Mahabharata when I was 8 years old. Yeah, I know, Krishna. I know. So bhakti is much more than that. And it is about process. It is about methodology. It's actually, we're not exaggerating when we say bhakti is a science. It's just a different kind of science, but it is a science. Sometimes we may think that, oh, we just say that just to make bhakti sound good. It's a science. It's a science. But in our heart, in our heads, we're thinking it's a belief. It's a belief. Right? So these are things I personally have been grappling with. So. All right. We don't want to go too late here. We do have other things on the agenda. Yes.